Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
We have to be ambitious, all of us, because we have to get the job done.
The US back in the game. We profile two urgent climate cases. From Pakistan, the young activist Aliza Ayaz joins us. And from a small Pacific island nation struggling to stay afloat, Anote Tong, former president of Kiribati, joins us. Then, pursuing the American dream, Minari tells that quintessential story, the resilience of a Korean family setting up a new life in America. I'll speak to lead actor Steven Yeun. And
only by really bringing the cost down can we make the case to them that they should stop building new coal plants.
Bill Gates tells our Walter Isaacson how to avoid a climate disaster. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. The race against climate change starts up again in earnest. Here in Britain, Prince Charles today warned that there is no time to waste. And with the United States now back in the Paris Climate Agreement this weekend, America's so-called climate czar, the former Secretary of State John Kerry, pledged that his country would lead a global response and warned that there is only 9 years to get our environmental act together. As he says, millions of people just have to look out their windows to see the effects of this emergency. Pakistan is one of the most climate vulnerable nations in the world. Monsoon rains are getting more extreme every year. And Kiribati, one of the world's poorest countries, a small island nation in the Central Pacific, faces complete obliteration as rising sea levels threaten to submerge it. The former president of this fragile paradise, Anote Tong, joins me now. And from Pakistan, the activist and UN Youth Ambassador, Aliza Ayaz. Welcome both of you to the program. President Tong, can I ask you, because you've been at this for, you know, for a long, long time, what does it mean to you to know that the United States is back in the game and prepared to again lead this challenge against this climate emergency? Do you expect something to change significantly?
Thank you for allowing me this opportunity, Christiane. Yes, when I first heard that the U.S. was withdrawing, it was really was one of the greatest disappointments. I've always believed that without the participation of the U.S., very little can be done. And so with the U.S. coming back on board, we're hoping that a lot of the disappointments that we had expected following the change in the administration from the Obama administration, we are hoping that there would be a renewed momentum adding to what followed the climate discussions in Paris. So I am very excited. I'm hoping that something we can hopefully avoid a lot of the tipping points that we were on the verge of surpassing.
We've said that you face a potential submersion. How bad is it there in Kiribati? How urgent is the situation?
Well, we've already been experiencing these impacts. We have communities who have had to relocate. We have king tides washing over the island and flooding, destroying crops, sometimes destroying homes. And so these are becoming more frequent. The question will be, as it gets worse, where do we go from here? And I think this is the question that we've really have not been able to answer, nor has the international community been able to address it.
All right, well, I'm going to come back to you on where do we go from here. But let me get a status report from Pakistan and Aliza Ayaz. You have been named a UN Youth Representative Ambassador for this. You are you're in Karachi, but you're at University College London. What is it that has propelled you into the forefront of this fight?
Lots of different factors and influences. I think moving around the Middle East and Europe has given me exposure to the stark reality of the climate crisis. I think what's special about being a climate activist is that more and more people my age were talking about the problems for people and really recognizing that human-environment connection exists. So I think because young climate protesters don't represent someone else's agenda or the message is strikingly direct and unvarnished, we can say a lot of things that elder adults can't.
Mm. So let me play for both of you, actually, this soundbite from John Kerry, because let's face it, the U.S. was absent without leave for the last 4 years. And like it or not, the U.S. is one of the biggest polluters and has the biggest throw weight in terms of the ability to help effect and propel change. So let me just play what John Kerry said about the urgency of this.
In rejoining, we got to be really honest with each other. We have to be humble. And most of all, we have to be ambitious. We have to be honest that as a global community, we're not close to where we need to be. We have to be humble because we know the United States was inexcusably absent for 4 years. And most of all, we have to be ambitious, all of us, because we have to get the job done.
So, President Tong, I want to go back to how we left it a moment ago. You said we've got to see where it's next going. So here's the climate czar, for all intents and purposes, saying that we have to be humble and ambitious. Where do you think, particularly for low-lying islands like your own and in the Pacific region, what's the immediate process that has to start?
Well, let me say that I absolutely have confidence in what Secretary Kerry will do. I know he's very genuine. But at the same time, we need to be able to come up with the answers. The question is, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has actually predicted that whatever happens, whether we cut emissions to zero, islands, countries like Kiribati, Tuvalu, the Marshall Islands in the Pacific Ocean will continue to be submerged over the decades. The question is, what can be done either to maintain the integrity so that of the island so that our people can continue to live there, or find alternative homes for them should that be the case. And so that needs to be addressed. The issue of climate-induced migration, I don't believe has been fully addressed at the international level. Hopefully, Secretary Kerry can provide the momentum in order to address these very critical issues for countries on the front line like mine.
Mm-hmm. So migration is a really, really important point. I want to just for our viewers show a little clip of two women from your island nation talking to a film crew not so long ago as part of a documentary that was called Anote's Ark. This is about a tsunami on your island. Here they are. So, President Tong, you can see the very real danger. So when you say moving people for their own good, you don't mean like people fleeing like refugees. You actually mean an organized removal of the entire population and putting them somewhere else.
Yes, yes. I've always rejected the notion that our people should become climate refugees. And the reason is because we do have more than adequate time to prepare them for it, because we know it is happening, it's inevitable, and we should plan for it. And so my response to that is that instead of having our people become climate refugees, they should be given the preparation so that they can migrate with dignity, people with skills to move into new societies, to become worthwhile people with dignity, and to be able to contribute in a positive way to the communities they move into. It's very doable. We don't want to repeat the same kind of mistakes that have happened in the migration, the massive migration of people from North Africa into Europe. I think that's a lesson that we need to learn from, and certainly not to repeat.
And Alisa Ayaz, in Pakistan, your country is obviously much, much bigger. I mean, you've got several hundred million population in your country, and you can't lift the whole population to another country. But there are major issues, right? I mean, it's not a greenhouse producing nation, but there is the monsoons, the trees and the logging that's going on. What are the biggest issues when it comes to climate in Pakistan?
Well, you know, more than 11,000 scientists in 153 different countries have declared a climate emergency. The UK, Canada, France, Ireland, New Zealand, they've all declared a climate emergency, but Pakistan's still far away from that. And I think as part of this emergency declaration, we should be contributing to the climate change mitigation and decarbonization efforts possible in our capacity and promoting what is a circular economy for sustainable development. I think such important measures will include utilizing renewable sources of energy and taking steps to reduce our emissions. Even though we are contributing to less than 1% of the global carbon emissions, like you mentioned, we should still keep in mind that national emissions will increase due to population, economic, industrial, and urban growth. So a major co-benefit of emission reduction will be improvement in our air quality. And I think another important aspect of the emergency declaration, or this issue rather, is that on climate change adaptation, without which we will observe major environmental disasters throughout the country. And in the very first year of this decade, as a climate change, you know, Pakistan witnessed a wide range of weather anomalies and related natural disasters, landslides, glacial lake outbursts resulting in flash floods up in northern areas, the change in precipitation patterns leading to river and urban floods, and the longer-term droughts in Sindh where I'm based. The recent wave of this unusual warmer winter season in the month of December is a present manifestation of climate change. And this is why I think climate change adaptation must be a priority for all sectors, and it should be incorporated as soon as possible in their policies and programs and action plans.
Alisa, when all those young people around the world following Greta Thunberg were marching all over the world, they were in Pakistan as well. And it looks like your government is talking about increasing solar power, but also electric vehicles, trying to bring that in. There are also obviously complaints about corruption, about the inability to actually get it organized in a way that protects it and that actually makes a difference on the ground. Can you talk to me? Plus, of course, is the plan to build, or rather to plant, I think it's 10 billion trees, because loggers and people just cut them down, which has its own negative climate impact. Where are those issues headed now? Do people have confidence in the government's electric car program or in the tree planting program?
I think there are mixed reactions here for the local population, and half the population believes that this is going to a long-term benefit, and the other half of the population still doesn't believe climate change is an issue that's going to affect them. I think that Pakistan's government needs to change and demonstrate through implementation and take a leadership position in climate change mitigation adaptation. The private sector and civil society both should also join hands to have a fully inclusive and coordinated response. And in such a holistic way, we will be adapting to a whole society approach. In terms of the proposed adaptation actions, you mentioned electric vehicles, the 1 million tree plantation. I think they're good benefits in the long term, but they're not immediately going to get us any results, since we're a long way from that, a lot of political and technical issues. But I think in the short term, we've got a bunch of different projects, from technical assistance with objectives around multi-sector projects with opportunities for climate and water disaster management, as well as effects in building climate resiliency for irrigation infrastructure.
Let me move to President Tong in Kiribati. Some of the methods that I read about trying to save your islands are just incredible. I mean, literally trying to lift the islands higher by a process of dredging. Obviously, you've got the sandbags, you've got all of this kind of stuff. Is that, I mean, your current president is trying to do this massive engineering job. Is that going to work?
I'm sure it will work, but the question will be, how sustainable will it be? Will it last for the next 20, 30 years, or not the next 100 years? Given what is happening on the with the environment, with climate change, I think it won't be for a very long period of time. But the question is, when is it? What at what point in time do we give up? Okay, and of course there is this desire to be able to continue to live on our home islands, and I understand that fully, and I think I actually subscribe to the same concept. But the question is, how sustainable? How much longer can we remain on the islands as we continue to raise the islands above the rising seas? This is very much an engineering question, and I'm afraid I've never been able to get a full answer to how do we do it. But yes, I understand that if we can remain on the islands for the next 50 years, so why not? I think the last thing we want to do is to lose our home island, our identity, our culture. So yes, I fully subscribe to the idea, and in fact, I had considered the same option. I looked at building floating islands, even the very thing that the current administration here in Kiribati is thinking about. And yes, I think it's clutching at straws, but why not? What options do we have apart from losing our home, losing our identity?
Yeah, it's very stark, obviously. And I think the current president has reached out to China to get them to put their, you know, expertise at the disposal. That's worried the United States. So can I ask you, President Tong, what you expect at the end of this year from COP26, you know, the delayed next Paris, or rather the, you know, the follow-up to the Paris Climate Accord, which the UK will host in Glasgow at the end of this year?
Well, basically the same thing that I was expecting at the Paris discussions, which I attended, and really a great accountability, a greater response by the international community to this challenge. We need to work collectively. And the question is, how meaningful are these things that are coming out of Paris that will come out of COP26? How meaningful would they be? Are they likely to be for countries who are very seriously challenged, who stand the real possibility of being submerged? Because mitigation is not an issue, and I follow what my friend from Bangladesh is saying. It's not simply about mitigation. It's about building the adaptation, the resilience to withstand the what it will be happening with climate change. So I've always been hoping that following the COP26, we in Kiribati will be able to have solutions, something like a firm commitment to provide us with a home for the next few decades. And I don't know if this would be possible, because the focus has been on saving the rest, but not those that have gone too far past.
Well, we are very pleased that we've been able to put this spotlight on faraway atolls like yours. So from Kiribati, President Tong, and from Pakistan, Aliza Ayaz, thank you both for joining us, two very strong advocates. Now, the climate crisis is, of course, inextricably linked with this pandemic. And in the United States, coronavirus has exposed a troubling new strain of hate crimes against its Asian community now, in the wake of what Trump used to call the China virus or the China plague and Kung flu. Immigrants to the country have regularly suffered racism, even as they give their all to the American dream. And a new film, Minari, is making waves. It's about a Korean family trying to build a new life in rural Arkansas as landowners and farmers. And here's some of the trailer.
여기 대체 어디야?
집이지. 우리 새로 시작한다고 그랬잖아. 이게 그거야.
아빠는 빅 가든 하나 만들 거야.
What a wonderful day to be in the house of the Lord. If you're here with us for the first time, please stand. What a beautiful family. Glad you're here.
How's your daddy like that new farm? He growing things good, doing things right?
Yes.
미국 애들은 할머니랑 같이 방 쓰는 거 싫어한다던데.
I don't like grandma.
걔는 안 그래요. 한국애니까.
Grandma smells like Korea.
Yeah. 뭐라고? Grandma smell?
Now, Stephen Young plays the dad who you saw in the red cap. His name is Jacob. Stephen Young is joining me now from Los Angeles. Welcome to the program. It's a remarkable film, and it's an unusual story of the journey. Tell me what drew you to it. Obviously, you know, you're also Korean-American. It's about a Korean-American family. There must be parallels. But what drew you to this script?
You know what? I think for me, what was really profound about the script was that it was confident in its own point of view. You know, for me, it's something that I always wanted to say, but it wasn't captured in very literal ways. It was really just about the fact that this story was about this Korean American family in and of themselves, that it wasn't juxtaposed to the majority or needing the majority in their family or in their story to justify their existence. But it was just a story about the humanness of these people. And that was really refreshing.
And, you know, toiling and struggling to reach the dream, which was actually the dream of your character, the father, Jacob. And the rest of the family, we can talk about this, were not necessarily fully on board with what you wanted to do, leaving California, coming into rural Arkansas to be a farmer. Here's a little clip that we want to play. It's you and David, your son, in the film, and you're trying to find water in order to plant, obviously, on the land.
David, 공짜로 찾을 수 있는 걸 돈 내고 사면 안 돼. For the house, we have to pay for water. 어? 우리 농장은 필요한 걸 다 땅에서 얻어내면 돼. 그게 바로 머리를 쓰는 거야. 알겠지? David. 우리가 그 stupid stick 썼어? 어떻게 찾았어?
머리를 썼지.
머리를 썼지.
It's really a very revealing clip. The story, it sort of shows this tension between you trying to make a better life for your wife and your kids, but how difficult it was. Do you succeed in the film? I mean, I don't want to do a spoiler alert, so you can tell us how much you want to tell us. And what is the tension within the family as you try to pursue this American dream?
I think, I think it goes beyond whether there's success or achieved or not. I think really the story is about a family assimilating to themselves, to each other. I think, you know, for my particular character, Jacob, he's kind of on a singular mission, and he puts the weight of his family and their existence on his back. And in some ways he kind of makes it his own and only his. And I think it's through the difficulty and through certain situations that he comes to realize that, you know, this experience is shared, that the family is going through this all together, and that it's not just on him. And so, you know, Jacob, his journey is really understanding that his family is so much more than their functions, that he is so much more than their functions, that they are just all in it together.
I thought the character of David, your son, and the grandmother who comes to live with you, the mother of your wife who comes to live with you, is really poignant. David has a bit of a heart condition, we understand. And the grandma is actually, you know, trying to bolster his confidence as well as anything else. Let's just play this little clip.
Hey. 교회 버스 왔어요.
데이빗 놔두고 너 먼저 가.
This just gets better and better.
됐다. 어느 사람이 그랬어? 아니 저렇게 무거운 걸 어떻게 들었어? 그렇게 무거운 걸 혼자 들었어? 아이고.
There's so many of these stories where the grandparents are such a glue to the family. What did you take from her role? And also Minari, the name of the film, I think the grandmother introduces that.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the grandmother for me represents so many things, but I think, you know, one special thing is that her point of view of how to love the children is unencumbered with duty. There's no sense of needing to teach them anything or making sure that she's correcting them. But rather she can just kind of just see from her point of view how to love these kids for who they are, regardless of anything. And I think That's, you know, a luxury that perhaps a grandparent has that a parent doesn't have. But, you know, as a parent myself, that was really profound for me.
And Minari?
Well, Minari is a beautiful metaphor. You know, Isaac, our incredible writer and director, you know, taking a little bit from his own life, grasped onto this plant that really spoke so deeply. It is supposed to represent, on a larger note, you know, Minari, actually you harvest the second growth of it. So the first growth dies and the second growth thrives and you harvest that. And it also purifies the soil and the water around it. And it was kind of representative of, I think, from my point of view, a boundless love, you know, that is represented at the hands of the grandmother. And so hopefully something that we can all kind of relate to.
Mm-hmm. You said Isaac, the writer-director, drew on, you know, his personal life, his personal story. You also, I want to ask how it, you know, how it reflects on your own experience as well, because you were born in Seoul, and then your family moved first to Canada before coming to the United States. We have this picture of you in kindergarten, and, you know, a close look at it is quite revealing because, you know, you've got all the kids in the kindergarten, and then you're sort of a little bit away from them. You know, they're all jammed together, and you're sitting a little bit away. What was it like being a little Asian kid in North America at that age? What do you remember?
I think a lot of things happened. You know, for me personally, I think it was the beginning of maybe feeling the feelings of isolation, of kind of having, you know, the framework that you understand up into, you know, 4 or 5 years old when I immigrated, kind of reconstituted or kind of broken down. And, you know, the difficulty of immigration for second generation kids is also that, you know, you're further and further pulled away from your parents' generation, through language, through, you know, your assimilation, and it happens slowly over time. And I think that has been kind of a profound theme overall in my life, that I think initially in my life served as something to either ignore or to be considered something sad. But I really do view it as this wonderful new perspective in my adult years of just understanding the singular place from which I exist and I kind of speak from. And so, yeah, it's been a crazy ride.
Yeah, it's been amazing, the reception. You know, I think you've got all sorts of awards and, well, nominations anyway in this award season. There's some controversy, I think, about one of the awards in which the film has been, let me just get that straight, it's been named in the foreign film category, right, for the Golden Globes. And, you know, some think that it should be actually in the English, you know, in the whatever, American English language category for best film, because it is by an American director. It is in America. You know, by far the required percentage of language is spoken. What's your view on that?
You know, on a whole, I think I'm very thankful to be part of this project. I'm thankful that I get to be part of something that challenges, I guess, the ways in which, you know, institutions and rules fail to acknowledge the nuance and depth of real life, you know, this country and many other countries, but this country in particular is made by the eclectic nature of so many different points of view, so many people, so many different cultures kind of coming together to service the collective feeling of this country. And sometimes we only get to see a specific picture of that. And, you know, what I love about Minari is that it challenges those notions. And I think people are hopefully made aware of what we're trying to say and what it kind of runs up against. But yeah, I'm really glad for this film.
And you've spent a long time. You're very well known for the series The Walking Dead. So you've already been challenging, I guess, stereotypes. And you've had a lot of, from what I read anyway, mail and response from viewers, whether they're Asian Americans coming from wherever, saying that you sort of blazed a trail for them. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, there is something new that I think a lot of us are touching on. Asian American representation and just kind of existence in America is something that I think is hard to pin down. Not because there isn't that existence, but because oftentimes it's framed between Asia or America. I think America tries to understand Asian America through Asia, and in reverse, Asia tries to understand Asian America through America. And I'm coming to realize that it's really its own space and its own thing and its own culture, and it is a part of this country. And so for me, I've always kind of had this desire to speak as honestly as I could from my point of view. I just never really had the framework or the words or the context to kind of say that to anybody. But in this work that I've been able to do and feel so lucky to do, I've been able to touch upon some things. And so, I'm just trying to really speak from me and try to keep doing that.
You know, just to go back to you, Stephen Yeun, as opposed to Jacob Lee in the film, I read that when your father decided to settle, and you're going to tell us where he decided to settle in the United States, he took a map and he said to your mother, I'm going to spit, and wherever my spit lands, we're going to go there. Is that true?
That's actually my uncle. My uncle did that.
Your uncle?
Yes, my uncle did that. He was the first one here, and he did such a crazy thing. He used to be a runner for docked, like giant, massive barges, and the crew that would occupy those things. And he kind of just took it on a whim, met my aunt, and spit on a map and went in a direction and created something from nothing—a very immigrant existence.
And you ended up where, your family, then?
We settled in Michigan. I'm from Michigan. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I started part of the lead to this by sadly remembering and reminding that Asian Americans through American history have come across their own very severe prejudice and racism. We remember what happened during World War II and the internments with the Japanese. But now, because of all this coronavirus and the language that was used by the former administration, we have actual hate crimes. There's somebody who's been killed. Did you imagine that might happen, you know, in 2021? Do you feel still that there is that latent prejudice against Asian Americans?
Absolutely. You know, there's always prejudice. I think people have a tough time seeing each other clearly. Sometimes we like to see people just by their identifiers or in the ways that they feel different from each other. And it's no surprise to me that, you know, the literal ways in which people tend to view the world sometimes ends up manifesting as hate and fear. It's sad that certain people get to amplify that and push that out and make that bigger than it needs to be and create terrible situations for individuals. So there's absolutely racism for the Asian American community.
And just very quickly, Minari obviously is getting a lot of Oscar buzz, and you're getting buzz as potentially a nomination as Best Actor. It would make you the first Asian American to be so nominated. What does that mean to you?
It's complicated. You know, I think it's it's not tied to the last question you just asked me, but I think in some ways it is. For me, I'm really just trying to speak from my own place, and I'm very thankful for any acknowledgement of my work. It's really cool. But, you know, these identifiers of being the first Asian American thing, I'm very glad to aid in breaking of precedent or the changing of rules and institutions in the ways that which we all collectively understand reality. But I also really, you know, can only speak from my place, and I only want to speak from my place. And I am Asian American, and that's something that I can never change, and I'm very proud of. So I intend to not die on any hills. I really just want to continue to evolve and grow and speak from my own place.
Well, good luck to you. Minari is a lovely film. Thank you so much for joining us, Stephen Yeun. And we return now to our top story, which is, of course, the climate crisis. While billionaire philanthropist Bill Gates has been working hard to help end this pandemic, he has never taken his eye off the growing threat to our natural world. Gates does not believe that the situation is hopeless, but he does believe it requires action and fast. He's put together a plan to reach zero global greenhouse emissions in his new book, which is called How to Avoid a Climate Disaster. And here he is with our Walter Isaacson.
Thank you, Christian. And Bill Gates, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
What have we learned from the pandemic that'll help us in the fight against climate change?
Well, the general idea that the government should think ahead about bad things. We expect experts to make those investments. So, you know, we have building codes to minimize earthquake damage. We've got the Defense Department to do war games and be ready for attacks. Sadly, in the pandemic category, we did not invest at all. And so our ability to diagnose travelers coming into the country and get going was very slow. Likewise for climate, you know, we haven't upped the R&D budget. There's a lot of areas of emissions that we're really not making much progress on. So sadly, climate change, it'll incrementally get worse and worse, and there's no tool like a vaccine that all by itself, even if you make the mistake, that helps you get out of it.
In your new book, you talk about how you first became interested in energy through your foundation work and the whole concept of energy poverty. Explain that to me.
Yeah, so in the year 2000, the Gates Foundation got going, and so I was making trips to Africa, parts that I'd never been to before, and seeing not only the lack of electricity, but also the precarious nature of the poorest there, who are overwhelmingly farmers. And, you know, some years their crops are less productive, some years they fail altogether. And so thinking about, gosh, let's get electricity to this continent, but what is this constraint of climate change and how bad is it going to be? I had the time to sit with experts. I was very lucky that they put a huge effort into finding the right people to educate me. And that got me super worried about what it means, not just for Africa, but for the entire world.
But isn't there some conflict between trying to make sure places like Africa get the energy that they need in order to become productive and growing societies and the issue of reducing carbon emissions on this planet?
Yeah, absolutely. At some level of wealth, the poorest countries, whatever the costs are for them to go green, should get subsidized. The extra cost I call the green premium. Now, when you move up to middle-income countries, even including India, Brazil, China, we can't afford to pay the green premium there. So only through innovation are we going to be able to say to India, please use the green approach. As they're building basic shelter, air conditioning, lights at night, you know, the very basic things that their citizens demand.
But they're getting a lot of their energy from coal-fired plants that are done cheaply in China, and China gets to export them. What do you do to try to resist that?
Well, coal, sadly, is the cheapest form of energy right now in most of Asia. The renewable prices have come down. That's fantastic. But often the, you know, where the renewable source is and when you need the power, they're far away. Even in China, you have to build that transmission. The Indian network, getting capital into it is tough because you have a lot of financial debts there and electric bills that aren't paid. And so only by really bringing the cost down can we make the case to them that they should stop building new coal plants. Almost all the planned new coal plants in the world are connected to India or China. And that's why China's so far only committed to reducing emissions by 2060. And so we'll have to help to some degree, but mostly take the incredible power of innovation, which the U.S. still is the by far the leader in that, and surprise people on how affordable we make it, not just for electricity, but also for steel and cement, where China in those categories has also got the biggest footprint.
We look at what happened in Texas in the past few days. The grid's been a mess. It hasn't worked. Some people there are blaming it on the fact that they were depending on windmills and turbines. What went wrong and what should we learn from this cold snap we've just had and the electricity problems it caused?
Well, this particular problem had nothing to do with an overdependence on renewables. Although some wind went down, the big drop was in the natural gas capacity in one of the reactors. These things can work in very cold weather, but they just saved the money and didn't weatherize them. I mean, natural gas plants and wind work in North Dakota, Alaska, Antarctica, and also their grid structure, where they're pretty isolated from the West and the Eastern grid. That meant that even when they had problems, they couldn't import power. There are weather conditions that, like cold fronts over the Midwest, where the amount of wind does go down. But that wasn't what we ran into this week in Texas.
Yeah, after reading your new book, I became so much more convinced of how critical it is to actually get nuclear power more into the mix. Tell me, what are you doing and what should we be doing to make it safer, cheaper, and to make it so it doesn't frighten people?
Yeah, part of the beauty of nuclear is that on a long-term basis, it actually has been quite safe. I mean, Chernobyl was horrific. Some awful mistakes were made. The biggest problem with nuclear today, besides these challenges of the public acceptance, are the economics. Westinghouse went bankrupt because their reactors had such big cost overruns. And there's very few plans, only two being built in the U.S., because natural gas is so cheap. It's outcompeted existing nuclear and coal very effectively. In fact, only the renewables in a complementary fashion are what is really being built in the U.S. right now. The exciting thing is if we start from scratch and we stop using high pressure water and we do digital simulations of all the safety and how to minimize the size of everything, we can build a reactor that is competitive and is dramatically more safe. The government had a funding round that TerraPower and some other companies, TerraPower's the nuclear fission company I've helped back. So we won the funding 50% from the private side, 50% for the government to take 5 years and build a demo to show that it's dramatically different. And so that, gives me a lot of hope that nuclear can play a role. I got involved just because of the need for climate reasons to have that as a very scalable, green, non-weather dependent way of making electricity.
Tell me why this nuclear power is safer.
Today's reactors have a lot of high pressure. And if you get a leak, then things want to get out. The fundamental problem is that as you split the uranium atom, and that gives you an immense amount of energy, the remaining pieces are radioactive. And so you need to basically guarantee that that waste is not going to get out, particularly up in the air. And, Chernobyl was where that was so awful. Now, we've known that we can build reactors that just by physics principles, there's no pressure in the reactor. There's nothing that wants to leave the site boundary. You have to move away from water and use a sodium metal coolant that many experimental reactors have used. And so that's the TerraPower approach. It means that there's enough new there that, you know, it's a big engineering budget, but we get huge reductions in the cost. And so, you know, even just in terms of having low-cost electricity, it's a big contribution.
I was surprised to read in your book that transportation, which I always thought was a big emitter of greenhouse gases, is actually much smaller than things like cement, as you say, or steel. Is there some way to try to handle the problems of cement and steel?
Those are particularly hard. And if you look at the cost of doing it in a green way, for cement, you have to double the price. With cement, you start by heating limestone, and that's a chemical reaction that releases CO2 to free up the calcium. And the heat you need very high heat, 1,400 degrees, and so you generally burn natural gas. So you have two reasons why that's CO2 emitting. Replacing the chemical reaction, it's going to require either capturing that CO2 or some ingenious approach. You know, we're backing, through Breakthrough Energy, a venture group I created, we're backing a lot of ideas about new ways of doing cement, but cement and steel, I'd put at the top of the list of things that are very, very hard to make the green product without a huge green premium.
You've always been focused on solving problems through technical innovations. But when you were doing your global poverty work, it seems to me that you eventually began to think it's not just about innovation, it's about government and getting involvement of policy as well. That got you a bit out of your comfort zone and you start having to deal with the policy and politics, not just making a new vaccine. Explain how that worked.
Yeah, I thought if the Gates Foundation funded the creation of new vaccines, that the uptake could be handled by others. And I could stick to the meeting with scientists and what we know about biology. In fact, what I found out early on as we looked at all the causes of childhood death, there were the two biggest killers, pneumonia and diarrhea. The rich countries had vaccines. They didn't need to be invented. In fact, they were getting to the kids at the lowest risk of those diseases. And so instead, it was about finance, it was about delivery, how you staff a primary healthcare system. And so amazingly, two of the things I'm most proud of are the Gates Foundation funding of Gavi, which was to buy and deliver those vaccines, and the Global Fund, which was focused on malaria, TB, and HIV. And those, our partners are completely the other governments. So, you know, I'm a friend of governments. You know, recently we've been raising money for coronavirus vaccines. I'm on the phone a great deal, not only with the U.S. government people, but, you know, government leaders all over the world. And so, yeah, that is a turnaround from when I thought, hey, just science, just innovation, you know, leave the government alone was the way to go.
And in your book, you talk about having to do that turnaround when it comes to climate as well. You can't just deal with the technology. You realize you have to deal with government. Tell me, in that dealing of government, how much of a change has it been dealing with the Trump administration and now dealing with the people around President Joe Biden?
Well, certainly on climate, the Trump administration was trying to stop things from being canceled. And so, you know, the tax credits, which have been very helpful, largely stayed intact. The energy R&D budget stopped going up, which it had done under Obama, but it was maintained, even though the executive branch said to cut it. The Congress kept it flat. Now, under Biden, they're prioritizing climate. The R&D budget will go up quite a bit, including support for things like nuclear. The regulations around how do we get transmission out. Hopefully, this Build Back Better initiative will include climate-related things like better transmission capability. The tax credits, we need to apply them to new areas like carbon capture and storage. So The dialogue is now very, very intense, and I think some good things will come out of that. Having said that, we don't want climate to be a purely partisan issue where, you know, when one party's in power, you make progress, some of the other ones in power, you don't. Because when you're saying to people who build steel mills or power generators, you know, every once in a while, these policies will be in place and then they won't. You can't make the hundreds of billions of investments in going green unless the core of the issue is agreed upon, even though, you know, it's good, actually healthy to have disagreement over the tactics of the role of the government and private sector and how do we get to that goal.
A lot of companies and individuals are reducing their carbon footprint by buying offsets. How do you do that personally, and how does one do it in a way that's not just greenwashing or like buying indulgences from some pope, and it's actually a real, actually does cover the carbon emission?
Yeah, so there's quite a variety of quality of offsets. I'm paying Climeworks, which up in Iceland does direct air capture and takes the CO2 and puts it in mineral deposits for millions of years. I'm buying clean green aviation fuel for my plane, and it wasn't available up in Washington State, so now I've made the largest individual commitment to them that they've gotten, and so I have that available. Now, obviously, using solar panels, electric cars. Another one that's interesting is that when they're doing a new low-cost housing project, I can put up the capital, so it's electric heating and cooling. They benefit by having lower monthly bills, and I take the credit for the fact that that's a much lower carbon footprint. So overall, I paid $7 million a year, which averages out to about $400 a ton. Now, it just shows that it's not scalable. You know, that's way too expensive. And so, you know, innovating down the green premium, you know, as I'm buying these products, hopefully that gets that going. In fact, we want to create an overall buying program called Catalyst, where we get governments and companies and maybe even individuals to give money in. Because when you buy green products, if it's the one that can, with volume, get very cheap, you're not only do you do that specific carbon reduction, but by bringing that price down, you're causing that whole sector to accelerate its transition.
At the end of your book, you talk about what we can do, including people like us who are not worried particularly about jet fuel for their jets. What is it each one of us should be doing each day?
Yeah, well, we really all have three roles. We've got our political voice and educating other people about why we care about this, hopefully on a bipartisan way. We've got our dollars as consumers, so buying an electric car, even though it still has a bit of a trade-off, contributes to the cause. You know, likewise, these new types of meat production products and all the products you buy, you'll have green ratings over time, and we'll get the quality of those to be so you can direct your dollars according to your beliefs. Finally, you know, wherever you work, they can make a contribution, whether it's their buying power, their skill set. You know, we see the finance sector, the tech sector all coming in and saying things like, okay, we can afford to buy green steel and cement. And so we'll help get that market going. Or we can make our data center so it's not just sort of green, but it really never takes any hydrocarbon generation to help power that data center. And so, you know, as companies, it's great that they're kind of competing to say, okay, we care about this cause because we're a good citizen, because our employees want us to. You know, that can help get even the hard parts of the problem on that learning curve.
Thanks, Bill, and thanks for the book, How to Avoid a Climate Disaster. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, great to talk to you.
Bill Gates always on the case. And finally tonight, a woman who's going to extraordinary lengths to avoid COVID lockdown. At just 21 years old, Britain's Jasmine Harrison is now the youngest woman ever to row solo across any ocean. She arrived in the Caribbean on Saturday after a grueling journey across the unpredictable Atlantic. Here she is getting her land legs back after the trip, which lasted exactly 70 days, 3 hours and 48 minutes. Now, this shiny new record is lifting spirits back home here in the UK, where the professional sailors have sadly just missed out on winning the America's Cup race again. Britain's only been trying since the contest began 170 years ago, but undaunted, the team vows it is determined to bring that trophy home next time. And that is it for now. Goodbye from London. Thank you for watching.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.